7. Elmswood High School, Pennsylvania. Today. I don't mean to be rude, Zig said, but let me be rude. Since when does Nola have a brother? I guess since birth, Roddy said, adding a puffy little laugh. Zig didn't laugh back. They split us up as kids, Roddy explained, standing there, one hand on his police baton, the other fidgeting with the tip of his black tie. He had spidery fingers that stood out even in the poorly lit stairwell. I stayed with our foster family, the LaPointes, but Nola got sent to... How'd you know my name? Huh? Before. You called me Mr. Zigarowski. Who told you my name? Roddy swayed there a moment, blinking slowly, like his wiring was slightly off. He had a nasal voice, high in pitch, but he also spoke slowly and precisely, like he had a plan, or at least knew what happens when there's a lack of one. From the story, in the newspaper. I saw it online a few years back, Roddy said with another slow blink. Nola's foster dad, Royal, Zig said. Yes, Royal. According to the newspaper, foster dad Royal was running some sort of scam against the military. Nola shut it down. They gave her a commendation and everything. That was the sanitized version that the military released to the public, though it left out the most important part. To save Zig's life, Nola had put a bullet in her foster dad's head. She disappeared soon after. She's my sister. My twin, Roddy added. Zig now doing what everyone does when they hear someone's a twin, looking for the resemblance, trying to decide if it's there or not. You don't believe me, Roddy said, taking off his police cap and revealing caramel skin, a pointy face, and a nose that had clearly been broken. He was young, late 20s. Though, as with so many cops and soldiers, his weary eyes, clones of Nola's, black with flecks of gold, looked like they'd lived through a few extra decades. I haven't seen her since we must have been 7. So a few years ago, you saw a mention of her online, and then what? You've spent all this time trying to track her down? Ever lost any family, Mr. Zigarowski? Zig stayed silent. I'm sorry. I offended you. Because your daughter passed away, Roddy said, Zig now realizing Roddy was missing that filter that stopped him from saying every loose thought in his head. I read about your daughter, Maggie, when I looked you up. Maybe it's better if we stay focused on Nola, Zig said, now replaying his call with Will from Dover. For some reason, the head of Dover, in charge of all their homicide investigators, was looking for Nola. Now her brother, a cop, shows up, doing the same. Whatever was really going on, it was bigger than anyone was saying, enough to bring Nola out of hiding. I'm not stalking you, Mr. Zigarowski. Nola's my blood relative. The only one I have. And I know this sounds a bit nutty, but it's like I can feel her out there, you know? Like she's my twin in ways that, again, a bit nutty. But it's like my pieces aren't pulled together until I... He took a breath. I just really want to find her. It wasn't completely nutty. Anyone with a missing twin would do the same. But as Roddy's spidery fingers pinched the brim of his police cap, Zig could feel that twitch in the back of his brain, the same one he'd get when he was reading the morning paper and saw a young person's obituary that was conspicuously silent about the cause of death. There's more to that story, Zig would think, which was exactly what he was thinking right now. Roddy, how'd you know Nola would be here today? Still staring over Zig's shoulder out into the hallway, Roddy said, You don't trust me, do you, Mr. Zigarowski? You think I'm here to hurt her? I met you 2 minutes ago. It's a little early to... I had problems when I was little. Real problems. But I've turned those around. I got help. I'm glad you did, Roddy. But that still doesn't tell me they knew each other. Pardon? Nola and Colonel Mint. They weren't strangers. Zig figured as much, but it was time to get more info. According to who? I'm police, Roddy said, pointing with his chin to the badge on his chest. That's my job, finding things that aren't meant to be found. Nola and Mint, they spent time together. Meaning they served together? Or they had something more... Huck! Huck! Please! Please, just wait! A female voice echoed from the hallway. Zig turned just in time to see a lanky boy with a long neck, Mint's son, as he burst through the gym doors, his mother Tessa chasing behind him. I can't, Huck pleaded, moving quickly, shaking his head over and over. He wasn't running. He was stumbling, practically falling, crashing on his knees, nearly slamming into the trophy case. Behind him, in the gym, the crowd was singing a hymn, "How Great Thou Art," their voices reverberating up the hallway. I can't, Huck repeated as his mother caught up to him, dropping to her knees and wrapping her arms around him, like he was a grenade and she was willing to take the impact. Huck, sweetie, I'm here, right here, Tessa said. She started to say something else, but immediately knew words weren't what mattered. I'm here. She repeated, hugging him tighter than ever, young Huck twisting and turning, his face bright red, his teeth gritted, his long neck trying to stretch out of her grip like his head was about to unscrew from his body. We'll get through this, Tessa insisted. Watching from the stairwell, all Zig could picture was his own daughter's funeral, right as it started. As they were about to walk out from the private receiving area and enter the room that held the waiting crowd. As Zig had stepped forward, he reached over to hold his wife's hand. She pulled away. Right there. Zig knew that Maggie wasn't the only thing being buried that day. It's too hard, Mom, Huck said. It is, Tessa agreed. But I'm still here. I'm not going anywhere. Now let's go make Daddy proud. And just like that, she tugged her son to his feet and they headed back toward the gym. God bless strong mothers, huh? Zig said, still in the stairwell. When Roddy didn't reply, Zig glanced over his shoulder. The stairwell was empty. Roddy and Agent Flatnose were both gone. Great. This was Nola when she was fuming. She was sketching, of course, sitting on the roof's parapet, which was covered in bird shit. She didn't care. Her pencil was moving in a blur. Four floors down, the crowd exited the funeral, streaming into the street like an ever-expanding octopus. A few were crying and hugging, but the majority were making small talk, checking their phones, picking out where to go to lunch. No surprise, Nola thought. Death was terrible company. Three steps outside the funeral and most people just wanted to get back to their lives. To those joining the procession, please put a magnet on your car and put your bright headlights on, a funeral employee announced. Also, with a crowd of this size, please be aware of your surroundings. Nola was most definitely aware. On her sketchpad, she drew every detail she remembered from the gym. The coffin in front, the pastor at the podium. She added some crosshatching to his chin, trying to get his face just right. He had watery eyes, cataracts coming. But the rendering, something still looked wrong. It was the same with every other face in the bleachers. From the man with the feral eyes and overgrown mustache to the 40-year-old woman whose kids sat next to her in size order. Everyone looked too angular. Her line work was short and choppy. Nola knew why. This was how she drew when she was distracted. Angry, if she was being honest. Fuming. She took a breath, closed her eyes. Mongol. Faber. Stettler. Ticonderoga. Swan. Nola flipped through the mental list the psychiatrists gave her for when her rage was too much. Mongol. Faber. Stettler. She tried picturing Lieutenant Colonel Mint, then the so-called funeral employee with the flat nose who she put down in the hallway. But all she kept seeing was Zig. Such a pain in the ass. She didn't like Zig. Didn't like the way he always looked at her with pity in his eyes, like she was someone he was there to rescue. It made her feel like she was 12 again. And if Nola wanted one thing in life, it was to never feel 12 again. The question remained, though. What the hell was he doing here? She sketched his face, the deep worry lines and wide eyes. He looked confused, almost as surprised as she was. Even when Nola was little, when she was drawing, she saw things. Things she didn't even realize were there. When her pencil hit the page, the full image appeared. Her art teacher, Ms. Sable, called it a gift. Army psychologists saw it as a different sort of asset, selecting her to be the Army's artist in residence. Since World War I, the Army had kept an artist, an actual painter on staff, to document everything from the beaches of Normandy to Vietnam to 9/11. With Nola's ability to spot things as she painted, like an elderly Iraqi man who was strolling through a village, she could find what everyone else overlooked, like the phone the old Iraqi was carrying. On that day, Nola looked up mid-brush stroke. The village had no cell service. Moving in close and putting a knife to the man's throat, she confirmed that what he was really holding was a detonator. According to her supervisors, Nola saved at least a dozen lives that afternoon. From there, the Army quickly realized that her observational skills were something they could use to track and kill those who did harm in this world, which was fine by Nola, since my God did she excel at that. Now sketching the edges of Zig's shoulders, Nola added two straps, a backpack for his mortician tools. Was that why he came? To work on Mint's body? That made some sense. Still, for it to be Zig of all people, no way was that coincidence. In her pocket were the ID and wallet that she'd swiped from the flat-nosed funeral employee she hit with the electroglove. Sergeant First Class Malcolm Green, at least according to his CAC, the ID card carried by all active military. 29 years old, from South Carolina. Like a careful soldier, he didn't keep any mention of his unit or who he worked for in his wallet, though as Nola flipped through his photos, she found a family pic from a recent holiday ball. Around his blonde wife's neck was the same type of gold charm so many spouses get from Rudy's Jewelry in North Carolina. The charm had a hand grabbing two lightning bolts. In gold, sparkly letters were the words Semper Vigiles, Latin for vigilant always. Fuck, Nola whispered, suddenly feeling like there were ants under her skin, crawling from the back of her neck and fanning out down her arms. That unit. She knew that unit. Of course it was them. Her past back to haunt her. Vigilant always. She started to sweat, scribbling harder now, searching to see who else they might have hidden in the crowd. Shifting the sketch pad, she took another look at her drawings of the pastor, then Mint's wife and kids, the crying boy with the thin neck and the daughter with the scabbed knees, Huck and Violet. There was something in their faces. Nola leaned closer, recognizing that cocktail of loss and anger in both their eyes. They'd never be the same. But in the daughter's eyes, there was something else, too. Defiance? Disobedience? Nola didn't have the word for it yet, but she'd seen it before in her own life. Loss was always the best tutor. In the distance, dozens of car doors slammed all at once, a chorus of mourners headed to the cemetery. Nola turned at the sound. Her pencil broke on the page. Mint's kids didn't deserve this. Pulling a new pencil from her bag, Nola added a few extra lines to the flag on Mint's coffin, replaying that day all those years ago when she first encountered that unit back at Warehouse 3, or as the military codenamed it, Grandma's Pantry. Nola scribbled the words below Mint's coffin, not even realizing she was doing it. "Fool. You're a novice fool," she told herself, erasing them just as fast. "When did you get so sloppy?" Though she knew the answer. This close to home. This close to her old life. To Mint and what he did for her. Then to have Zig show up. That was why they'd sent him, wasn't it? The dumb old dope was so excited to come back, he didn't even realize he and she were being used. As always, the unit had a simple goal before they attacked. Make her emotional. Careless. Nola was usually too smart to let things get personal, but the way her blood was starting to churn, no. Don't let them dictate your path. Find your calm, and you'll find who's behind this. Forcing herself to keep drawing, she held her pencil tight, sketching bystanders in the bleachers. She tilted her head, taking notice as one in particular came into view. The man was squat and wore a uniform. A cop, Nola realized. But as she started filling in his face, those eyes. She knew those eyes. They were just like hers. No. She hadn't seen him in decades. But there he was, in the crowd at the funeral. Her twin brother, Roddy. Nola's pencil stabbed through the page, nearly puncturing his face. He was polished and clean now, a cop, but at his core, she knew who he really was. Nola was moving now, scrambling, bits of gravel spraying across the rooftop, her brain churning through all the possibilities. The fact that Roddy was here, that meant he knew. He knew the truth about Mint, that she and Mint get out. Now, she told herself. Bursting into the stairwell, Nola darted down, 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 praying she had it wrong. She needed to run, leave, get answers. Jumping down the last three steps, she hit the push bar at full speed, sending the metal door swinging wide. Someone was crying, and a few mourners still lingered in the parking lot. Nola lowered her head, speed walking toward the lot. She thought she'd had it figured out, even the Zig part. But with Roddy in the mix, the way he was hiding there, lying in wait, a darker thought filled her brain. Mongol, Faber, Stippler. She didn't want to think it. Her head was still down, trying to stay out of sight. When Nola first heard what happened to Mint, she immediately came running, like this was one of her old missions. But it was time to admit, this wasn't a mission. It was a trap, and she was standing at the center of click. Sergeant Brown, you seem like a reasonable person, so I'm going to make a reasonable request. A man whispered behind her, pressing his gun to the back of her head. Show me those hands. Nola started to turn, reaching for her electro glove. And don't think I'm going to let you zap me in the head. Malcolm's still pissed about that, he said, yanking the glove from her hand, the speed of his attack sending her colored pencils flying across the asphalt, his gun still at her head. He was massive, but spectacularly fast, in a cheap suit just like the other so-called funeral employee. The giveaway was his weapon. Please just make this easy, Sergeant Brown, he added, pulling down on the bolt release. Nola knew that sound. Submachine gun. Special forces. Without a word, Nola raised her hands in the air, smiling. He pulled out his handheld mic. I got her. Package en route, he said. Yeah, don't worry. I'm on it. Shoving her forward with his gun, he reached for his handcuffs. I don't know what you did, Sergeant Brown, but damn is my boss excited to see you. 9. Wunderly Square, Pennsylvania. He's a big fat liar, Wags said through the phone. You don't know that, Zig replied, gripping the steering wheel, the small earbud microphone swaying near his chin. I do know that, Ziggy. And you know how I know? Because you looked him up. Because I looked him up. And more important, because of what I found, Wags said. As head of the FBI unit that gathered terrorists' biometrics from explosive devices, Amy Wags was a master at uncovering what people left behind. As Zig's first friend at Dover, back when her husband had decided he was gay and asked for permission to date his law partner, Andrew, she was also a master at Zig. Can I make a prediction, Ziggy? Is this a real question? Or is this like that time when you tried to convince me that oatmeal cookies were real cookies, even though we both know they're cruel insults made of cardboard? Wow. Going with an old joke about oatmeal cookies, she said, well aware of how Zig always dealt with nervousness. That's a new joke. And an old habit. Remember that night on the first anniversary of your divorce, she said, when Charmaine posted all those Facebook photos of her and her friends at some bar, all of them making horrible kissy faces and toasting with their fruity pink drinks like it was some middle-aged bachelorette party? You know how many jokes you made that night, Ziggy? Zig stayed silent, remembering the photos perfectly, especially the one where Charmaine, his ex, was smiling wide, looking genuinely happy. On that night, Zig didn't call anyone, but Wags called him. This is me, Ziggy. No more jokes. Whoever's chasing Nola, however she's tied to Colonel Mint's death, I'm telling you, the more you dive into this, the more you're gonna get hurt. Wags, I appreciate the concern, but you're not listening. This is what Nola always does. The moment someone puts their neck out for her, she chops their head off. Glancing in his rear view, Zig spotted a black Acura. Washington, D.C. plates. Not a big deal. D.C. was barely an hour and a half away. Can you please just tell me what you found about her brother? No, not until you open your eyes. I know you and Nola have a history. She grew up in your hometown, and more important, was friends with your daughter. This has nothing to do with Maggie. Wags let out a laugh, a real one. You really can't make peace with her, can you? Who? Nola? Or my daughter? There's your problem, Ziggy. Sometimes I'm not sure you can even tell the difference. With a tug of his sweaty hands, Zig pulled off at the exit for his small town of Wunderly Square. Where nature smiles for 5 miles, read the homemade wooden sign. On his right was the town's main strip mall, which always reminded Zig of the Twin Pines Mall from Back to the Future, where the DeLorean first hits 88 miles per hour. Doc Brown had it right. Time travel was risky. By the way, Ziggy, in case you haven't noticed, Nola didn't ask for your help. In fact, near as I can tell, even after they tried to nab her, Nola actively avoided your involvement. So, let's start again. Why are you suddenly so obsessed? Hitting the brakes at the end of the exit ramp, Zig eyed a heavyset Hispanic woman on the side of the road. She was dressed in a ratty Philadelphia Eagles t-shirt, selling flowers from a white plastic bucket. Locals called her Big Philly. Zig called her Luciana. Gerber of daisies, Luciana mouthed to Zig, pointing to her beat-up assortment of red, orange, and yellow flowers that everyone knew were the week-olds from Bouquet of Sun, the local flower shop. As usual, Zig rolled down his window and gave Luciana a dollar. As usual, He didn't take any flowers. I asked you a question, Ziggy, Wags said through the phone. Hitting the gas and watching Luciana shrink in the rearview, Zig noticed that the flower lady was waving. Not at him, but at the next car that had just come off the exit. Black Acura. Washington plates. Zig squinted, trying to get a better look at the driver. The sun visor was down, blocking the driver's face. Zig made a quick left. The Acura went right. Other side of town. Zig kicked himself for being so paranoid. Wags, what number date are you on? You're trying to change the subject. I'm making a point. You and the deuce, Zig said, referring to the guy Wags had been dating for the past few months, the first real boyfriend she'd had in almost a decade. His name's Mikkel. Don't insult the deuce like that, Zig teased, using the name that Wags instantly regretted telling him was on Mikkel's personalized license plate. The Deuce, named after the 32 Ford coupe that his grandfather used to drive. So, date number 6 with the Deuce? Number 7? Date 11, Wags said. Today's our 2-month anniversary. He sent me a corsage. Wait. An actual corsage? Like for prom? Don't make fun, Wags warned, Zig now hearing a soft pop through the phone. Wags, I need to know right now. Did you just open that little plastic corsage box? Because I'm currently picturing you sniffing it like you're wearing a puffy dress in the back of a limo. There was a long pause and a soft snap. You just put it back in the box, didn't you? Zig, you said you had a point? My point is simply that even someone new in your life, like the Deuce, if he was in trouble, you'd want to... No, no, no. Don't you dare try to use my good thing to make your bad thing look good. You don't even know Mint. My job is to take care of our fallen troops. That was your job, not anymore. You left it, remember? So please spare me the high and mighty speech. It's not a speech. I know. It's your mission. But you heard what his wife said. According to our records, Mint's last assignment wasn't at Dover. He was a reservist doing security work at FIG, she said, referring to the Pennsylvania military base known as Fort Indiantown Gap. Zig didn't say a word. Wait. Wags said, you already looked him up, didn't you? Of course he had. Who'd you sweet talk? Esther in Veterans Affairs? Wags challenged. Connie in Personnel. You called Connie before you called me? I used to work there, Wags. I can name Connie's grandkids by heart, including the little one who they dressed like a Harley Davidson biker for Halloween. So she told you. Mint was assigned to Dover only since last night. They gave him pencil orders. Zig nodded. He'd seen it before. When a government spy was killed overseas on a secret mission, Dover sometimes used pencil orders to hide where they were really stationed. Giving them orders that were penciled in made it look like they worked at Dover. That doesn't mean Mint was spec ops or some secret squirrel, Zig said, remembering the medals on Mint's chest. The average spy had far fewer. Sometimes when a government big shot dies, like a senator, Zig added, they can also get pencil orders to bring them into Dover, so they get our good morticians, rather than some local funeral home. Either way, your so-called friends at Dover were lying to you, Ziggy, and when you called Will to ask him, he kept that lie going. Maybe he's just trying to protect Mint's privacy. Or maybe they know it's the best way to suck you in. Mint's one of us. And now you'll come running, which is exactly what you did, isn't it? Then all you had to do was spot Nola, which, no surprise, you did that too. I love that you're one of the kindest people on the planet, Ziggy. But I've seen teenagers in horror movies who were less predictable. Car washes that were less predictable. I get the point, Wags. Ferris wheels that were less predictable. Now you're rubbing it in. And being overdramatic. No, I'm being smart. I know what getting that phone call meant to you. I know the past few years haven't exactly been packed with excitement. You didn't see the look on Nola's face, Wags. She knew she was being followed. Whoever's chasing her is now potentially focusing on you. Is that your grand plan? Put the bullseye on yourself? Zig stayed quiet, making a left on Citrine Avenue, a narrow street dotted with beat-up birch trees. Within half a block, houses started popping up, most of them one-story bungalows with little front porches that people actually sat on rather than just used for ornamentation. Ziggy, if you think there's something fishy with Mint's death, he was shot in his own driveway. Of course it's fishy. Then call in help. And tell them what? That the head of Dover didn't tell me everything about his private investigation? That's not a crime. That's a... Zig's mouth stayed open as he turned onto his own block. Halfway down, a police car had pulled diagonally into the street, blocking Zig's way. Ziggy, you okay? Wags asked in his ear. Unclear, Zig said, slowing down and bucking to a stop. The door to the cop car swung wide. A short man in a dark blue police uniform stepped out. Mr. Zigarowski, nice to see you again, said Nola's brother Roddy as he flashed a broken smile. You got a few moments to chat. 10. For the rest of his short life, Conrad Ben would regret this moment. He's in, yeah? Conrad called out, rushing past the secretary, a middle-aged Asian woman with smoker's lips and Velcro carpal tunnel wrist braces that everyone knew were just for show. Don't, Ms. Lee warned, barely looking up. Conrad was still moving, his squatty legs pumping, his square face sweaty, his fist about to knock on Mr. Vess's cherrywood door. Mr. Vess said if I found something. He said to interrupt. Young man, I'm trying to help you here, Ms. Lee said. She called everyone young man since employee retention wasn't exactly Mr. Vess's strong suit. Perhaps you should start again and ask me who Mr. Vess is in there with. Conrad froze, his knuckles now inches from the door. He knew that tone. His daughter? His daughter, Ms. Lee said, undoing her Velcro straps. Shit, shit, then redoing them. Born in a spotty Armenian neighborhood outside of Cleveland, Conrad was a big guy, but never a bright guy. As a high school football player, he'd earned the nickname Volcano when, during a steroid rage in the school parking lot, he punched his fist through someone's driver's side window and, of course, required surgery. Definitely not bright. But that didn't mean he was dumb. Putting his ear to the door, Conrad heard electronic beeps and boings. Are they? Ms. Lee nodded. A few weeks back, for his daughter Nessie's birthday, Mr. Vess had bought an upright vintage video game. Frogger. Original console, original paneling, refurbished joystick. Every day after school, this was their ritual. Daddy and daughter time. Yet, if you think it's worth bothering him, Ms. Lee added, like she was enjoying herself, I guess I really can't stop you, can I? Conrad glanced down at his phone, a single bead of sweat skiing down his square face. He's said to interrupt, he whispered, more to himself than anyone else. Ms. Lee offered nothing but a shrug. Shht, shht. This is stupid. Mr. Vess told me if we found something... Never finishing the sentence, Conrad rapped his knuckle against the office door. The video game went silent. There was a shift in the air. Conrad took a half step back. He could feel it through the door, like when the T-Rex turns your way in Jurassic Park. Something was coming. It's the turtles. I hate those turtles. A slow voice grumbled through the door, using two distinct syllables for the word turtles. Mr. Vess always spoke slowly, every sentence expanding and filling the room, like he was daring people to interrupt. "Mr. Vess?" Conrad asked, leaning in toward the closed door. "You talking to me or your do—" "Speak quickly," Vess's voice insisted, though it took 5 full seconds to get the words out. The door was still shut. He wasn't opening it. "Sir, I found that thing you—" Conrad paused, careful of who else was listening. "You should see this, Mr. Vess." The door opened just a few inches, Mr. Vess's knife of a nose and yellow teeth glowing through the crack. Conrad slid his phone toward the gap. It was yanked from his hand, the door still barely open. Conrad could hear Mr. Vess breathing through his nose as he studied the photo on the phone. "Who's the cop?" "You don't want to know," Conrad said. "And the guy with him?" "That's who Dover called in, still trying to figure out why. From what we can tell, he's got a personal interest in Mint's case, already making calls and sniffing everywhere." "He got a name?" "Jim Zigarowski. They call him Zig." Mr. Vess continued staring at the photo, the glow of the phone lighting his face. He tended to see things in black and white. You're good or you're bad, smart or dumb, loyal or a rat. "Dad, come on," his daughter pleaded, the beeps and boings of Froggers starting up behind him. "Call in the Reds." "Sir, you sure that's—" Conrad stopped, started again. "There are easier ways to—" Vess shot him a look. Argument over. As Vess had learned years ago from his grandmother, some businesses succeed by making noise. Others profit only when there's quiet. "Call in the Reds. And I assume you have an address for Mr. Zigarowski."
11. "Ziggy, say the word and I'll send help," Wag said in his ear. Zig stayed silent as he got out of his car in his driveway. His right hand skated toward the knife in his pants pocket, while his other hand tucked his phone into his shirt pocket. Even as Roddy approached and Zig slammed the car door, Zig didn't shut off his phone. If things went south, better for Wags to be listening in. "Roddy, what a true joy to see that in addition to invading my personal space, you've driven over an hour to show up at my home," Zig said, adding an extra scoop of charm, hoping it would diffuse whatever was coming. "Though if you're here for the block party, you're actually 2 weeks early," he added, loud enough so Wags could hear. Roddy didn't laugh, didn't even grin, like he was still processing that. "I get it. You're making a joke." "That's funny," Roddy said, his odd smile back in place. He took his cap off his head, revealing short black hair that was shaved to the scalp on the sides. Big yellow letters on his car door read, "Jersey City Police," a Jersey cop out in southeastern Pennsylvania. Whatever Roddy was up to, he was crossing state lines to do it. "Would you mind hanging up your phone, Mr. Zigarowski?" "My phone isn't—" "I can see your mid-call," Roddy said, holding up a small high-tech tablet, the kind that usually only feds had. Zig still didn't hang up his phone. "Mr. Zigarowski, I'm obviously here to talk about my sister, and I have a feeling you want to hear what I'm about to tell you. I can't do that if there's a stranger listening in." Zig stood there a moment. He didn't have much choice. "Ziggy, don't hang up," Wags called out. Click. She was gone. Roddy said, making a satisfied noise as he stared at his tablet. The line was clear. "My foot fell asleep 2 times today. You ever have that happen? twice in one day. Zig just stared at him. Roddy, back at the funeral, you said you had problems when you were younger. I'd like to know what those were. Roddy barely moved, staring up at Zig's gray clapboard bungalow with the white trim that needed painting. You worry about her, don't you, Mr. Zigarowski? Nola. Your body shifts when I say her name. You're her friend. I didn't think she had anyone who cared for her. If you have a specific quest, you understand that she and Colonel Mint, they knew each other, Roddy said, his voice slow and methodical. Knew each other where? From one of Nola's first assignments, where she did one of her first paintings, at a place called Grandma's Pantry. 12. Guidry, Texas. 21 years ago. This was Roddy when he was 7. Once again, he was hiding and chewing gum, juicy fruit. They were all hiding and chewing gum, him, his foster sisters, and his foster brother, huddled together at the top of the stairs, spying down, like they were trying to spot Santa Claus on Christmas. But this definitely wasn't Christmas. She in trouble? One of them asked. Chew, chew, chew. They all chewed back. They didn't have to answer. Nola was always in trouble. It looks like... I think she's eating, said the oldest, Anne Marie, squinting through the slats of the banister toward the kitchen, where their mother and father, Barb and Walter Lapointe, were serving Nola dinner. Mac and cheese. Not just any mac and cheese. Space Jam mac and cheese, plus the rest of Nola's favorite meal, chocolate milk and Oreos. Double stuff, of course. Here you go, sweetie pie, Walter said. That was the tip-off. Nola was never sweetie pie. Only his 3 biological kids were. Knocking the Oreo plate aside, Walter slid a vanilla icing sheet cake in front of Nola. From upstairs, the kids couldn't read the bright green letters. We will miss you. Nola looked around, confused. This will be your last night with the family, Walter told Nola matter-of-factly. What's going on? Why are you doing this? Nola asked. Upstairs, at the back of the pack, young Roddy was silent, tucking his gum under his tongue. He knew why they were doing this. 1.5 years ago, twins Nola and Roddy had been rescued from a brutal group home in northern Arkansas. Someone had shown Barb Lapointe a fax with their photos. She took it as a sign from Jesus, driving to meet the adorable twin 3-year-olds. To her surprise, Roddy and his sister, with identical bowl haircuts so that predators wouldn't know Nola was a girl, were 3 years older than the group home had disclosed, with behavioral problems omitted. On his first night in Texas, Roddy refused to get undressed, sleeping in his clothes on the couch. He did the same on his second night, so Barb slept on the chair next to him. When Barb woke up, Roddy was at her feet, like a loving cat. Progress, she thought. The twins had matching black eyes with flecks of gold and the same honey-colored skin. But Roddy's disarming grin made him more charming and likable than sullen Nola, and also more dangerous. At the end of their first week, Roddy's foster sister Anne Marie noticed that one of her gold bangle bracelets was missing. Roddy found it in Nola's room. Thank you, Anne Marie said, pulling him so close his cheek was pressed into her breast. You're the good one, she whispered. Over the next few weeks, a window in the house was broken. Toys began to disappear, then were found in Nola's room, always smelling like urine. In no time, the Lapointes were worried about the safety of their own children, a worry that deepened when someone set fire to the living room carpet. Therapists came to visit and things went back to normal. Then Nola came home with a black eye and a ruthless hospital bill from a ferocious boy in 5th grade whose front teeth she'd knocked out with a steel thermos. Miss Nola, Walter said in that tone no one argued with, it's time to go. No, Nola replied, tears swelling in her eyes. Walter seized her arm. No, please don't do this, she yelled, trying to pull out of his grip. At the top of the stairs, the other kids curled together, watching helplessly. What are they doing? The youngest, Paulette, whispered. Keeping us safe, Anne-Marie replied. Behind them, Roddy kept to the back of the pack, his head down so no one could see the joy that was spreading across his dark eyes. 10 minutes ago, when the LaPointes said they wanted to speak to Nola alone, Roddy thought they'd found out the truth. It was him. Roddy was the one who'd broken the window and peed on the toys, just like he was the one who stole Anne-Marie's bracelet and hid it in Nola's room. It was even Roddy who picked the fight with Thermos Teeth, telling the ferocious fifth grader that he'd spit in the boy's backpack. Roddy was about to get his face punched in, until Nola came to his aid. Sure, Nola was the one who set fire to the carpet, a rushed and poorly considered plan to protect the family dog, whom Roddy was chasing around with a candle. But right now, that was the least of Nola's worries. Someone. Roddy. Help. Roddy, please, Nola begged, fighting to break her foster father's grip. At the top of the stairs, Roddy didn't move, didn't make a sound. He was just a kid. He could never have engineered, much less foreseen all this. But to watch it play out, naturally, he felt bad. But if the choice was between Nola taking the fall or Roddy confessing everything, well, that was no choice at all. Don't make this harder than it is, Walter LaPointe said, tugging Nola's wrist. Please. I'll be good, she yelled, bits of Oreo spraying from her mouth. She was clawing at his hand. Her foster mom was crying. We'll both be good. Don't look, young Anne-Marie whispered at the top of the stairs, covering Paulette's eyes. Roddy didn't take the advice. Leaning between his foster sisters, he gripped the wooden guardrails like jail bars, chomping on his juicy fruit as something new filled his chest. He thought it was another rush of power. But it wasn't. It was a thrill. That was the only word for it. The thrill that comes from getting away with something. A dark grin spread across his face. No matter what Nola said, no matter the proof, would they ever believe Roddy was the guilty one? They would. For months now, the LaPointes had known the truth. They knew both twins had problems, but it was Roddy who needed more help. Money was tight. With three other kids to take care of, they could help one of the twins, but not both. Barb LaPointe prayed on it for a week. The decision was clear. Find Nola a new home. She was the strongest one, the resilient one. She'd be okay. I'll be good. We'll both be good, Nola begged. We won't bother anyone again. Da-da-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding. The doorbell rang, playing the Yellow Rose of Texas, though Roddy never knew the name of the song. No, please, Nola begged as Walter scooped her up. She grasped at the kitchen chairs, the phone cord, anything to get a handhold. Barb was sobbing as she followed them to the living room, prying Nola's grip from the threshold. Please, Mom, don't give me to them. Don't give me to them. But it wasn't them. It was him. To this day, Roddy could still remember every detail. The diagonal view from the top of the stairs, the curve of the wooden guardrails in his hands, even the sweet smell of the juicy fruit as the front door opened. I'm here for the man never finished his sentence. He had a pitted face, greedy eyes, and incredibly long eyelashes. I'm Royal Barker, he explained. Walter went to shake his hand, but he was still holding Nola, like a thrashing bride on the threshold. Royal cocked his head at the sight. You must be Nola. Dead. Please, Nola begged, trying to grab at the door. I'll be good. I swear I'll be good. It would be 21 years before Roddy saw his sister again. 13. Today. Grandma's pantry, Sig repeated. You don't know what I'm talking about, do you? Roddy asked. He was smarter than Sig first thought. When Roddy stared at you, his black eyes fixed like an anchor, it was easy to think he was socially awkward, which he was, but he was also clearly analyzing every detail he observed. What about Rashida? Have they told you about her? Roddy, you just drove really far to get to my house. If there's something you want to know, can we just get to it? Out of nowhere, Roddy turned to his left, staring up the block. All was quiet. A second later, a black car zipped across Citrine Avenue, just as Roddy knew it would. The car was gone in an eye blink. Sig now noticed that Roddy was wearing a hearing aid of some sort. Were Jersey cops allowed to serve with hearing aids? Have you seen this painting, Mr. Zigarowski? Roddy held up his tablet, swiping to a photo of a canvas covered in watercolors, grays, drab browns, and at the very center, a mix of yellow and black. The painting was of someone's cubicle, but it looked like it had been painted years ago. Big gray computer monitor, messy desk. The focal point was a soldier in a black windbreaker sitting in profile working at the computer. Two other younger soldiers, a black woman and a black or maybe Hispanic man, wore matching windbreakers and stood behind him. All three of them were studying the big monitor. A black and yellow patch on the woman's shoulder showed a barely readable scribble underneath. Semper Vigilis, Latin for vigilant always. I assume you know who painted this? Roddy asked. Sig motioned to the bottom corner of the painting, which had a signature line in white block letters, N. Brown. When was this painted? It looks old, Sig said, though it wasn't just from the outdated computer monitor. The art itself, the soldiers at the center. It looked more rudimentary than Nola's usual paintings. When she was artist in residence, you know what her job was, right? She painted disasters. Sometimes disasters. Sometimes total horrors. Sometimes the mundane, Roddy explained, shaking his leg like it was asleep again. For over a century, the army had had a painter on staff documenting the country's greatest battles. 5 years ago, when they hired Nola as artist in residence, the army told her she could go wherever she wanted. Afghanistan, Syria, anywhere. War painters get full clearance. In fact, on the day this painting was created, a Pave Hawk medevac helicopter crashed in Bahrain. 8 service members, including 3 doctors and a reporter, were killed. Time magazine made a cover story of it. Sig remembered the story, and the bodies when they came through Dover. Sig had worked on the co-pilot, a Marine, whose head was cracked open like an eggshell. Sig spent 9 hours wiring the man's skull together, then personally polished his wedding ring, which somehow had gotten looped onto a cracked rib. When they presented the ring to the Marine's family, his wife threw it back in Zig's face, screaming that this wouldn't bring back her dead husband. Why are you telling me this? Sig asked. That medevac story was impossible to ignore. It was national news. Most war painters would have headed straight to Bahrain. Instead, for some reason, on one of Nola's first days on the job, she headed here. He pointed at the painting. Grandma's pantry, Sig said. This was one of the very first pieces of artwork she painted. Sig took another look. So what was the mission in Grandma's pantry? It's the title of the painting. But Recognize any of the soldiers?
Zig looked closer at the painting, the soldier sitting at the desk. His face was in profile, but his forehead, his hairline.
Mother trucker.
Lieutenant Colonel Mint? Roddy swiped to a new photo, the back of the canvas, where Nola always ID'd her subjects. On screen, three names were handwritten in block lettering. Archie Mint, Rashida Robinson, Elijah King.
From what I could find, all three were in the same unit, Roddy explained, swiping back to the painting and enlarging the photo to enhance the logo on Mint's jacket.
A hand grabbing two lightning bolts. Semper Vigilis.
Army Security Agency, Roddy explained, again checking over his shoulder. This time the street was quiet. Dates back to World War II, where they did high-end investigative work, top secret and above, stuff they didn't even trust to the Army intel folks. Oddly, the unit was supposedly disbanded after the Cold War.
Yet here they are, doing an investigation big enough that it made Nola ignore the number one military story in the country, just so she could come see it, Zig said as Roddy again made that sound. He didn't have to say anything else. Whatever Nola was chasing all those years ago, and whatever Mint was investigating, their paths crossed here, at a place called Grandma's Pantry, a military location whose real specialty so far seemed to be making high-end secrets disappear.
What about Rashida and Elijah? Zig said, referring to the other two soldiers in the painting.
Have you tried reaching out to them?
Roddy offered a flat gaze, handing Zig the tablet.
Swipe left.
On screen was a new photo of a burned-out car, half of one, really. The back seat and trunk completely missing, the blackened car sheared in half.
This was yesterday, around midnight, down by Sunco,
Roddy explained, referring to one of the many refineries near the Philadelphia airport.
Zig swiped left, to another angle on the car, this one slightly closer. Through the missing front windshield, there was a single figure, scorched from fire, slumped toward the steering wheel, her head dangling in that way that heads are never meant to dangle.
Police report called it a suicide.
Said the car rammed full speed through the refinery's metal fence, crashing into one of their big rinsing tanks. When you mix chemicals and combustion like that.
Zig swiped to the next picture, a crime scene close-up of just the woman, her body burned so badly that she was nothing but a charred black crisp shaped like a human. One of her arms had somehow been spared, showing a patch of dark brown skin. Rashida Robinson.
Fallen number 2548, Zig thought, catching himself. This wasn't his job anymore. He wasn't assigned to put this woman to rest.
Still, it's hard to look at, yes?
Roddy asked.
Sadly for Zig, it wasn't. During his decades at Dover, the very worst part of the job was that he got used to it. Death should be a stranger, not someone familiar. It's why he left Dover and its never-ending stream of young cadets sliced down in their prime, their families clinging to God and hating God all in the same breath. It's why Zig had sworn he'd never go back. And yet here he was, staring down at this woman's burnt body and blackened teeth. With a few swipes to the right, Zig returned to the back of the painting and its three names. Archie Mint, Rashida Robinson, Elijah King. 2 days ago, Mint had been shot dead outside his home. Last night, Rashida Robinson was found dead, too. It was a hell of a coincidence. Or, Zig was starting to realize, not a coincidence at all. Whatever really went on all those years ago at Grandma's Pantry, someone seemed to be working their way down the list of the investigators who were stationed there.
You understand now?
Yes,
Roddy asked.
That leaves Elijah. And Nola,
Zig whispered, the air going quiet. She was just the painter, though. That doesn't mean anyone's coming for her.
You sure about that?
Roddy asked, grabbing the tablet, his spidery fingers swiping to a new photo. He held it up for Zig. On screen was a muscular man in a suit, curled on the ground and holding his leg, clearly in pain.
Staff Sergeant Buddy Adcock, one of the undercover agents stationed outside Mint's funeral. He's a meat eater,
Roddy said.
Apparently, he surprised Nola as she headed toward the parking lot, tried to put cuffs on her.
Oh, jeez. What did she do?
Yanked a pen from his front pocket and jammed it into his kneecap, popping it like a bottle cap. He's currently being prepped for surgery to repair the dislocation.
Zig stared at the photo, at the pen protruding from the staff sergeant's knee, and at the man's oversized pistol lying there on the sidewalk. An MP7 submachine gun. Not a normal service weapon. Which meant this guy, Adcock, was
Special Forces, Zig whispered.
At a local funeral.
In a small town, Roddy said. That seemed normal to you, Mr. Zigarowski.
Zig stayed silent, and now he was the one checking over his own shoulder. Yesterday, the higher-ups at Dover had pulled him onto this case, clearly hoping to put their eyes on Nola. But if Special Forces was involved, pulling weapons like that? They weren't just trying to talk to Nola.
They were hunting her.
Zig took another look at the young soldier, curled on the sidewalk, clenching his teeth in pain.
This, Zig knew, was the moment he should walk away. This has nothing to do with you.
For all he knew, Roddy was in on it too, using Zig to flush her out.
You look like I'm causing you pain, Mr. Zigarowski. You're worried I want to hurt her.
Roddy, I just met you. Roddy's face shifted.
I'm not a perfect person. I'm not proud of everything I've done in my life. But you know why I'm a good cop? Because I don't care if people like me,
he said, suddenly serious. It's a bigger asset than you think. It lets me ask hard questions and get real answers. But if you think I'd hurt my sister, I never said you'd hurt her. She just, when it comes to Nola, I'm not sure you understand what you're getting into. She's not going to want your help, my help, anyone's help.
That doesn't mean she doesn't need it.
Zig thought about that, and once again, he could see 12-year-old Nola at the Girl Scout campout, down on the ground, clutching her bloody ear after a can of orange soda exploded in the fire.
Get her help. Get her to the hospital, Zig's daughter was screaming.
Yet what Zig remembered most was that when he reached down to scoop up Nola, she recoiled, scratching at him like a cornered cat. Half a second later, she caught herself, realizing Zig was just trying to help. No one else saw it, but Zig did. Even at 12, Nola's instinct was to fight back.
Garowski? Mr. Zigarowski, you okay?
Zig looked up at Roddy.
No, he wasn't okay.
As he thought about it now, he hadn't been okay since the moment he walked into that funeral and saw Nola across the gym. For 2 years now, he'd been able to keep that part of his brain, his heart, in check, or at least tucked away. And then, at just the sight of her, it was as if someone had jammed a shovel into his chest and dug everything out, every old feeling, every wound, and every fear about Nola, about his time at Dover, about his own failures, and of course about his daughter. Wags was right about that. It always went back to Maggie. Before Zig left Dover, he'd spent over 2 decades working on the bodies of fallen soldiers. For Zig, being around the horrors of death meant that Maggie's loss was somehow less. In the darkness of Dover, he could escape the blackest caves of his own life. Of course it was an illusion, As any mourner knows, when you bury someone you loved deep to your core, all it takes is a familiar smell, an old song, or even rusty high school lockers to bring back the pain. Mr. Zigarowski, I've been tracking Nola for 2 years. Even if you can point me to her friends, she doesn't have friends. The words came so fast, it took Zig a moment to realize it was the most honest thing he'd said. Nola had no friends. She had no family. She had no one. Except, weirdly, Zig. I know you care about my sister, Roddy said, his long fingers again fidgeting with the tip of his tie. This is your chance to finally help her. She could use that help right now. Pure manipulation, Zig thought, looking back at the photo of the young soldier in the fetal position, gripping his knee in agony. Wags was right about that, too. The last time Zig had let Nola into his life, she didn't care who she hurt. She tore everything to shreds, shooting her own foster father in the head and wrecking his corrupt military unit, while Zig nearly died in the process. Nola Brown is a gun. She's a weapon, someone at once told Zig, describing her time in the military. You point her at something, and you'll get what you want. But just know it may come back in pieces. Zig looked up from the tablet toward his house. For 2 years now, he'd been putting his own pieces back together. After Maggie's death and the divorce, he'd rebuilt his life, rebuilt his work at Dover. In fact, when he finally left Dover behind, he thought he'd turned a page, leaving the worst days behind him. The last thing he needed right now was to turn it all back into a jigsaw. Walk away, Zig told himself. Leave it be. But as he played it through his head, two people were already dead, Archie Mint and Rashida Robinson. He could see Mint's son, Huck, the boy sobbing with his mom in the hallway, his daughter, Violet, with the scabs on her knees and the vacant look in her eyes that would take a lifetime to fade. These people, all of them, had hopes and dreams and lives. If Zig walked away now, if Nola was next on that list and she was killed too. No, don't even think it, he told himself. But that was all he could think. If he walked away and something happened to Nola, this would be on him. He already blamed himself for his daughter's death. He couldn't carry another. You're going to help me, aren't you, Mr. Zigarowski? You'll come? What? Come where? She won't listen to me. She runs every time I show up, Roddy said. Wait, you know where she is? I got the call on the way here. We need to hurry. She has no idea what's coming, Mr. Zigarowski. Now, do you want to help Nola or not? 14. Elmswood, Pennsylvania. 30 minutes ago. You can't park there, the valet called out. Nola ignored him, shutting the car off and stuffing an iPhone into the glove compartment. The phone belonged to Buddy Adcock, the staff sergeant who'd pulled his gun and tried to handcuff her near the parking lot. While he was on the ground gripping his knee, she'd swiped it from his pocket. I'm looking for Richard Mirante, Nola barked at the valet, flashing the badge she'd found in Buddy's wallet. From the same unit, Semper Vigilis, and using the name she'd found in one of his emails. To protect against moments just like this, DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, was in charge of encrypting Army cell phones. But there was nothing DISA could do to stop Nola from pressing Buddy's thumb into the phone's fingerprint reader, adding her own thumbprint, and having access to everything Buddy and his unit had been looking at. Best of all, she'd pulled out the SIM card, so the government couldn't track her. But by holding on to the card, she could slide it back in for easy updates. Ma'am, you hear what I... Nola shot him a razor-sharp dagger of a stare. The valet stopped mid-step. He wore a bright yellow rubber bracelet with the name of the local high school imprinted on it. In his hand, his phone screen was open to an Instagram model who was shaking her fake boobs in a way that only a high schooler might think was normal. Just a kid, Nola realized. If this is about the murder, the valet stuttered. Mr. Marante is right in... She walked past him, toward the front door. Slam! Inside, the restaurant looked like any other overpriced steakhouse. Dark wood furniture, bright white tablecloths, blood-red walls, and the kind of low lighting that was supposed to be sexy chic, whatever that meant. Searching for her pencil and notepad, Nola reached into her pocket. Empty. Left it in the car, she realized, cursing herself for yet another rookie mistake. What the hell is wrong with you? Pull it together. Too late for that. Between Mint's death, Roddy's arrival, plus everything she was working on before this happened. Find your calm, she told herself. Or as Mint himself used to say, get emotional and you get dead. It was good advice, given to her at Grandma's pantry. But what Nola appreciated far more was the genuine concern that came with it. The way he'd looked her in the eye and grabbed her shoulder as he said it. He was concerned about her. For Nola, that was a rare thing. A new thing. One that wouldn't be forgotten. It was that thought that actually worried Nola, who didn't like this feeling. Of being worried. Of the lack of control that came with it. In her pocket, she started doing that thing she used to do when she was little, and Royal would bring over those friends who would stare at her a bit too long, using her nails to pinch the skin on her thigh, distracting herself with pain. Today, in her pocket, she pinched herself even harder. This case. It was more than just a case, which really was the issue. From her first days as artist in residence, like any painter, Nola had been taught to remain objective. But considering her tie to Mint, she was anything but. No way could she ever repay him for what he did that day she needed him most. At the back of the restaurant, a middle-aged man with thinning blonde hair and trendy oversized eyeglasses was sitting alone at a private booth, clicking at his laptop. His sharp black suit made it look like he had money, but even from here, Nola spotted his shoes. Cheap, scuffed, worn. Not a customer, an employee. Richard Marante, Nola announced. Yep, give me a sec, Marante said, still clicking at his computer. An ancient IBM ThinkPad with a University of Michigan sticker, and one that read, I'm not superstitious. But I am a little stitious. There was an iPad right next to it. At the middle of his nose were two red indentations from when he'd lower his eyeglasses to read. Needs bifocals. Too stubborn to get them. Nola slapped the laptop shut. Hey! She pulled out her stolen badge, nearly ramming it into his face. I need you to answer some questions. He didn't look surprised. Another detective? I assume this is about Wojo, he asked, referring to the valet who'd been killed 2 nights ago. Actually, Nola said, no longer pinching herself as she slid in across from him in the booth. It's about a bit more than that. In the corner by the bar, a waitress with a hacking cough was restocking martini and shot glasses. Nola shot her a look that sent her back to the kitchen. Nola took a final scan of the room. All clear. Yet what she couldn't see was the valet out front. The high school kid with the yellow rubber bracelet was no longer staring at Instagram models. He was dialing a number he'd memorized. It rang twice before someone picked up.
Yeah, you said to call if that you'd pay for...
The kid cut himself off, keeping his voice to a whisper.
I saw her,
he said into the phone.
The girl you showed me, with the white hair. She's here. I saw her.
The young valet went silent, listening closely to the instructions on the other end.
Yeah, no, Don't worry. She's not going anywhere.
15. Elmswood, Pennsylvania. Now.
You've been here before? Roddy asked.
Years ago, Zig said, tugging the steering wheel, his car creeping past the valet stand and the low cobblestone wall that lined the curved driveway of Barron's Steakhouse. With your wife? Back when you were married?
Zig didn't answer.
That place where you live now, that's not far from your old neighborhood, is it? Roddy added. And Nola's old neighborhood, too, when she was little. For the entire 40-minute ride here, this was what their trip was like. Roddy shouting out everything that came to his brain, peppering Zig with question after question. But as Zig steered into a nearby parking spot, he had to admit, Roddy wasn't wrong. He might be a bit of a social misfit, but his cop instincts were solid. His conclusions were solid. His concern for his sister seemed solid, authentic. But still, for Zig, there was something about Roddy, like an itch in Zig's head, something that just set off his primal radar. Heart or no heart? Zig still wasn't sure.
Can I ask you a question? Zig interrupted.
You do that a lot, Mr. Zigarowski. You ask a question before you ask the question.
Zig took a breath, put the car in park.
Finding my address isn't hard, but to be waiting for me at my house. How do you know that's where I was going?
For once, Roddy was silent.
You tracked my phone, didn't you?
That would be illegal,
Roddy said, sitting there in the passenger seat, staring straight ahead. Taking a breath, he finally said,
I followed you from the funeral.
Zig replayed his ride home.
He'd checked over his own shoulder half a dozen times.
Apparently, Roddy was there, right behind him, the entire way.
I'd like to go inside, Mr. Zigarowski, Roddy added, reaching for his holster and pulling his gun, a tactical-looking 45.
Yet what unnerved Zig far more was when he noticed that the pistol had a threaded barrel, the kind you screw a silencer onto. Definitely not department issue.
Roddy, wait!
Too late. He was already gone, darting toward the open back entrance of the restaurant.
Zig was two steps behind him, reaching for the knife in his pocket and praying this wasn't a mistake.